Hi, this is James Kandasamy. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I appreciate you. I know I provide a lot of value through this podcast, and I want you to share it with your friends, with your families, and anybody else that you know that kind of benefit from listening to this kind of content. Go and share it through Facebook, through LinkedIn, through Twitter, through Instagram, or any other channels that you want to share it, because sharing is caring. Thank you. Let's go on with the show.
I wanted to introduce you guys to James Kandasamy. I've known him for quite a while. I'm going to say he's a Longhorn because he lives in Austin. If he's not, just don't tell Alan Stewart. James is a client, a friend, and kind of a, I don't know what the right word, confidant, or kind of a, we kind of brainstorm, kind of mastermind about plans and fund of funds and other interesting things. He's got very unique mindset. And I really enjoy kind of figuring out how he's looking at things. We actually look at things very similar when it comes to structuring deals. How do you create win-win situations for everybody? James has been very successful in Austin. He's got his own book. I read it when it first came out, and I believe, James, you said you were going to, offer everybody a free copy. As you guys know, at the end of the show, it's recorded. Jeff has to do his little magic tricks with it, Jeff and Rob, and then we will send it out tomorrow morning with a copy of the PowerPoint. I think James is going to put a link to his book. I highly recommend reading it. It's very interesting. Not as interesting as what you're about to hear from James, but is James unmuted, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm unmuted. Can you hear me?
So, yeah, James, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll
open up the screen. Well, you're saying about that you know me for some time, and I just remembered that I think 2013 is when I bought my first house. You gave me the first hard money loan, and we didn't even know that until like 2 months ago.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
I was only 30. I was the Longhorn hard money guy, and I was like, oh, really? Okay, that was my first house, right?
That's funny. Wow.
I only realized it like 2 months ago that, you know, you were behind that, right? So...
have you paid me in full yet?
Yeah, I think so. Good. And we also caught somebody trying to do a fraud, right? Remember?
Actually, you know what? I do remember that.
Yeah, because somebody was like trying to, you know, take my email and send to you and ask you for money. You know, you're trying. I mean, that was like maybe like fifth or sixth house at that time.
I think it was Greg that did that. Greg. He took your email and then asked for a raise. Yeah. So James, tell us about what you're doing in multifamily and, what you're expanding to, and then we'll I'll put up the screen and we'll start talking about
So I'm a multifamily deal sponsor or syndicator, where we put money together and buy apartment complexes, right? We focus a lot on class B and C. I mean, right now more class B, focusing a lot in Austin and San Antonio market. Right now owning 2000 units. Yesterday we closed our 10th acquisition, 263 units, which is I call it a COVID deal, the first COVID deal, right? So
congrats, man.
thanks.
I heard you had a really hard time raising capital under one of your structures.
Oh, no. It was like we raised it in 24 hours.
Yeah.
5 hours. Maybe 3 hours, because after that becomes a sleeping time, right? So the next,
right.
I counted 12 hours to raise the whole thing, but only 5 hour waking up time, right? By the time I'm awake, I'm done, right?
So most people count days or weeks. You count sleeping hours versus waking hours. That's interesting.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that structure on how did we do it and why is it so interesting for a lot of people, and how did I change my structure? Because I was always stuck on one structure. And when I wrote my book 2 years ago, I was looking at a lot of research about different structure and making sure that I can explain it as as independent as possible, right? Without any bias on structures, right? Because syndication structures are very personal, and everybody have their own thought process on how it should be done. And, we want to go through that in a short while. But I wrote a lot about this 2 years ago in my book, when I launched my book, like I think 1.5 years ago is when it came out. But 2 years ago, I was already, writing about, these different structures. So about myself, as I mentioned, focusing on Austin, San Antonio, more than 130 million asset under management. Now it's probably like 165 or something like that. 2,000 units, 10 apartment complex, raised almost $50 million. Single GP. We only my wife and I. There's no other GP in our deals. And I, of course, I have a key principal, like some people that like John Montero, who helped me with the with the balance sheet and loan as well. And he gives a lot of really good advice as well. So we are vertically integrated. We have our own asset management, construction and property management ourselves. So we have like 40 staff working for us. Maybe now it's like around 45 with the new acquisition. I'm also author of the best-selling book and sold 2,000 paid copies, not the free one. I'm not even counting the free ones. It's just paid copies. People are just buying it in Amazon. It's $20 in Amazon, and you can buy in Audible, you know, physical copy or even Kindle version as well. I also have my own podcast, which is called Achieve Wealth Podcast, Achieve Wealth Through Value at Real Estate Investing Podcast. Or also Facebook group, which is like 7,000 people in the past, maybe 1.5 years, maybe 2 years. I can't remember, but you know, 7,000 in 2 years is awesome. Right. And also I have my own mentoring program, a small one, not a big one, but I do have students who are learning on the details of syndication, raising money, property management and asset management as well. So let's go to the next one.
Oops. Did I hit the next one? That was an accident.
Yeah, correct.
So James, you and I have talked about this. Actually, we talked about this several months ago.
Oh yeah,
kind of the optimum deals and basically, I mean, you already know we're syndication lawyers, and about 80% of our deals all look the exact same. They're all structured the exact same way, mm-hmm. And especially if you look right now, everybody's got a deal. Everybody's trying to raise capital. It's the fourth quarter, and nothing happened in Q2 or Q3, so everything is being compressed into Q4. And there's lots of deals out there. And so you and I have talked about kind of these win-win type structures. And it was interesting because you're the first person I've talked to I'm going to say this the wrong way and don't take it the wrong way, but in the mom and pop aggregation of multifamily. I only mean that because as a corporate lawyer who was formerly a bankruptcy and workout lawyer, I dealt with the large private equity funds. And the structures look nothing like this. And so you and I had some interesting discussions about 3 or 4 months ago, and you were introducing structures that were very familiar to me several years back. And those are the structures I like, but part of the issue is you've got to almost train some of the people out there that you want to bring into your deals, how to understand these and why they're actually better than some of the existing structures, because it puts you and the LPs on the same playing level. And it's almost like we have to tell them today why they want to like these type of structures. It's still good for the GPs, but the GPs have to perform in order for them to make money. So what you could go ahead and kind of start this slide off. I just want to give a little intro.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think a few months back when we were under COVID, I was trying to set up a distress fund, and I was really trying to figure out how do I make a structure which is very, very good for the fund on the sponsor side. And also I want to make sure the passive investors are taken care of, right? Because that's how a fund would fly, right? Because a fund, when you don't have a deal, you know, you have to really sell the story of the fund, right? So when we were trying to look at that, and I think me and Merrill were like trying to brainstorm what is the best structure here for everyone, right? I mean, of course, I didn't create that fund. I ended with the single purpose entity deals. But that puts a lot of thought process. And recently I did a deal, which, you know, after a lot of thought process, because I've been always doing one structure for my entire career, right? Until recently, right, where I changed and put a lot of thought process into it, put a lot of pro and cons, and I came up with a really good structure. But, you know, as I said, structure is a structure, and we're going to discuss about it. You know, you want to really see how it's benefit the passive investors, you know, how it's going to motivate active investors. So in my mind, when I was doing this research for the past, 4 or 5 months on what's the best structure moving forward, how can I really, you know, first of all, convince the passive investors, at the same time, convince myself that I am going to be motivated to do this kind of difficult deals, right? If the structure is not very motivating for the sponsor, I'm not going to do it, because what's the point, right? We work, I mean, I can be like a normal person, like everyone, just do the normal structure. Everybody knows about it. Nobody talks about it. But I don't want to do that. I want to do really good deals. At the same time, make a lot of money for investors, make a lot of money for the sponsors, and everybody be happy. But what is that structure, right? So in my mind, I come up with these three most important components on a good deal structure, right? So good deal structure, you have to be a win-win between the general partners and also the limited partners. And this structure, because I don't want to keep on changing structure, because then you are giving a lot of different thought process to different people during different deals. What I said is, okay, this structure need to be really good structure during all economic cycles, during the up cycle, during the down cycle. And also, it should take care of any deal performance of the sponsor, right? All of the deal, right? So deal, if a deal's doing very well or deal's not doing very well, it should be, you know, able to take care of the passive investors very well, because passive investors are the one that enabling GPs to really do the deal. And I want to make sure that we really take care of them, right? Second of all, the second point is basically we want the structure to motivate the sponsor to push for the deal performance, right? You know, if you're doing a deal which is, if a structure is very, very monotonous, very, very single motivation level structure, then there's no real motivation for the sponsors to push, right? And this is something that passive investors need to understand. If they really want to maximize their investment, the structure need to be optimized for the sponsors as well to perform in certain ways while taking care of their fundamental expectation of a deal, right? So that's why, you know, second thing is you need to motivate sponsors. The third one is it also need the structure need to be able to address a variety of investor preference, right? A variety of investors, expectation, right? So when I wrote my book, if you look at chapter 3, when we talk about considering deals, you know, everybody have different expectations. Some people have, you know, I want cash flow. And some people said, I want an equity multiple because I want to multiply as much equity as possible when I really want to retire. That's why I want cash flow. So we want to do, you know, how do I create a structure which address that, right? So let's go to the next slide.
So what you're saying is go to a second. So, and I try to do these as well. We've talked about this. So you're wanting to create a structure that captures the largest group of investors, knowing that you can have four investors and each one of the four investors have different risk levels, different goals. There are different points in their lives where, you know, like someone like my dad is used to bonds, which now are garbage, but in the old days he would want a bond that just paid a coupon. Correct. And you and I have talked about this, and I've got it in one of my current structures and you've got it where you're essentially paying a coupon. And it's interesting. There are quite a few people out there that want a coupon. And you're about to go into this, but the reality is you're decreasing the cost of your capital by offering the coupon. At the same time, you're offering an investor an opportunity to get into this with very, very minimal risk. It's a great idea.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, you have to understand people when they, let's say you have 200, 300,000 to invest, right? If you're young, if you invest in three cash flowing deals, you are done, right? For 1 year, you're done. You have to accumulate for another few more years to accumulate that money to do it, right? But if you invest that in a, you know, in a deep value add, you can multiply that money, keep on multiplying, right? So everybody have different options when it comes to where are they in their investment cycle and how much money they have to invest and what are they looking for? Are they looking for cash flow or are they looking for equity multiples, right? So two major structure that a lot of people are aware of. In fact, I wrote it in my book 2 years ago as well, because that's what I know. I mean, this is very high level. There's a straight split, 70-30 or 80-20. And the second major structure is a preferred return structure, right? So we're going to go through that in a short while on, you know, what are the pros and cons of each one of these and we'll discuss, right? So next slide, please. So on a straight split, I think a lot of people are aware. Straight split is very, very easy to understand. People like it because it's easy to understand. You can take anyone from the road and say, hey, I share, 50-50 or I share 80-20 or 30-70, anybody can understand, right? So it's very easy to understand. And also, you know, there's a lot of arguments saying that this is alignment of interest. You make money, I make money. You make money, I make money, right? We just share, right? So I would say that, yeah, there is alignment of interest between GP and LP. But there's also a cons to it too, right? The pro is easy to understand, alignment of interest. And I'm going to go through a few more things as well, but the cons to it is like also this, you know, whatever straight split is, you know, you have to really read the company agreement and understand the structure. Otherwise you can go into different interpretation or manipulations, right? So the problem is not many people are very well versed in looking at the company agreement and understanding the structure, right? So for example, first of all, when they talk about 80-20, what does it mean? Does it mean carried interest or does it mean equity split? Right. So let me tell you what's the difference, right? Carried interest means is 80-20 on the profit that's being made. Let's say you have 100,000. So carried interest means, let's say the deal become 100,000 to 120,000. So the 20,000 is where you take that 80-20 split, right? But they are also 80-20 split where they say, I give you 100,000, 80,000 is yours, 20,000 is mine on day one, right? That's also 80-20, right? But so if you say it very quick, things can change, right? So, and you'll be surprised on how many structures are out there which have an equity split. But when I explain it very well in a simple manner, people said, oh, I wouldn't invest in that. But I can tell you one thing. Go back and read your company agreement. See what did you invest. Right.
You should have a lawyer. You should have a lawyer read your company agreement.
Yeah, correct. So it's no, there's another way of, interpretation of 80-20, right? Sometimes people say very quickly, oh, I do 80-20, but the 80% can be for the GP.
Right.
I mean, you think it doesn't happen, you'll be surprised on how much within our network it does happen. It's just people don't read the company agreement.
Yep.
Yeah, so, I was looking. Yeah, go ahead, Merle.
I was going to say, so tell us about equity split from day one. You talked about that. Mm-hmm. What is a swap sharing? Tell me about that.
Swap sharing, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Sometimes when people say 80-20, I mean, it's a general understanding that 80% goes to LP and 20% is the GP. But the other day I was looking at a company agreement from, you know, somebody within our network. That person is doing 70-30, but 70% is going to the GP, 30% is going to the LP, right? So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, if people know how I explain it, I mean, that's a bad deal for passives, right? But, you know, when you do a straight split, it's very difficult to really understand unless you go and read the company agreement.
Right? So, James, are you telling me that my last Helium deal that I raised capital for, which was a 60-40 split, 60 for the GP, 40 for the LPs, is a bad deal?
Good deal for the GP, but bad deal for the passive.
Yeah, I would argue for multifamily, absolutely. For other things like oil and gas, they're all
oil and yeah. I'm not aware of all that. Yes.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So they're very heavily weighted towards the other end because the return, if you hit, it's always a big if, but if you hit, you know, you're talking 5, 10, 15 times multiple on your money. Even at a 60-40 split, 60 going to the GP, 40 the LP. But with high reward, there's very high risk. So the odds of hitting some of these are, you know, 1 in 10, 1 in 100, but you don't have the same risk with multifamily. It doesn't go to zero.
Correct. Yeah. I'm talking about the general multifamily that everybody thinks that they understand the structure, but you know, they want to go back and read and see whether they really know what structure did they invest in.
So the next one is very important. I think we should spend a couple minutes on operational cash flow.
Sure.
There is a big discussion because people don't understand the return of capital versus the return on capital. It's not that they don't understand it. They don't understand how it affects them when there's a payout on a sale, because they're thinking they're going to get a certain percent of the return based on how much they invested. But in reality, they may have been under a return of capital structure. So there's a different payout based on how your documents read. You want to go into that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is very interesting because I think it's one of the very, very subtle, it's just within on and off, right?
So one letter, right?
One letter change and that becomes different, right? So let me explain very high level, right? In the investment world, there's two worlds, right? One is called the tax world and the other one's called investment world. In the tax world, whatever distribution, whether it's return on capital or off capital, is always considered as return off capital. So that's on the tax world, right? So we want to put that aside. But on the investment world, so let's say, I'm not talking about refinances or sale, right? I'm talking about operational cash flow from the real estate. So let's say you're putting in 100,000 and you're getting 10,000. What that 10,000 is that interest or is that your own money, right? So it is your own money if it's written off capital, and if it's interest, it's written on capital, right? So any investment, you always want to make sure it's written on your capital, right? I mean, you cannot go and put a CD for 100,000 and get, you know, part of the CD, let's say they said 5% CD interest rate. They can't be like taking from that 100,000 and giving you back saying that this is your 5%, right? They should need to create 5% on top of that 100,000, right? So just because of that, when you do a return of capital as part of your return, when you say 80-20, that 80-20 automatically becomes 70-30 or 60-40, And the way it happens is because the money is being returned throughout the operation, at the sale, your bases have already been diluted, right? You've already been reduced. So let's say you put 100,000 for 5 years, you get 10,000, 10,000, 10,000 for 5 years. At the sale, the sponsor just need to give back another 50,000, right? He don't have to give back 100,000, right? But on a return on capital, that 100,000 is preserved until the end, right? So when preserved until the end, all the money you make during the operation side is all profit, right? Whereas on return of capital, you are not making any money for the next 5 years, right? Let's say it's a five-year horizon. You're making zero money. All your risk is at the sale, right? So it's a very, very high risk in my mind when you do return of capital.
It's good for the GP because the GP, now the GP only has to satisfy, in your example, 50 grand, and then the GP starts splitting. There's 70-30 split. So it's to a much greater benefit to the GP. So, you know, when you're getting into these deals, you want to ask those questions, you know, are you treating this as a return of capital or return on capital to your sponsor? Because there's a huge difference.
Oh, well, it's a huge, always, huge difference.
Can be. Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about monetary terms. I'm on top of monetary is also risk, right? I mean, if you're not making money for 5 years, you're actually losing money, right? I mean, because inflation eats your money, right? And the whole thing is contingent upon whether you're going to make money at the sale, because you're not making money during operation, right? So go back and read your company agreement, see whether you're getting back capital or you're getting back profit during operation.
And yours are return of or on?
Of course, on capital, yeah.
So are ours.
Yeah. We always make sure that the investors' money are preserved until the end. And only at the end when we give back the investors, and then on top of that is where we do any splits.
Right. Now, a couple of deals I've done in the past, they are return of capital. But we made it very clear to the investors up front that we are treating this as a return of capital, but gave a very high pref on it to help compensate for that. But you're absolutely right. You need to, because there's so many different ways to structure deals, and the difference between two consonants are incredible, of and on. I posted something like 2 or 3 weeks ago on COVID, and it was kind of a thing where, hey guys, it's very interesting. The CDC decided to count COVID deaths as from COVID, and now it's with COVID. There's a big difference dying from something and dying with something. A motorcycle crash, you die, but you had COVID when you tested. That means you died with COVID, and they're counting that as a COVID death. Before, they were telling everybody you were dying from COVID. So again, prepositions, you learn this in law school, change the meanings of just about everything. And of and on are huge here. So
yeah.
So the last...
And 90% of the deal are return on capital. Very, very few people are doing return of capital.
Right.
A smart passive investor would catch it very quickly.
Right. Were you saying I'm not smart?
No, of course you know that, right?
So the last one here is the motivation for sponsor.
Yeah, basic motivation for sponsor, right? So as I said before this, right, I said there need to be some motivation for the sponsor to, you know, push the performance, right? Because they are making money on the upside of whatever they started with, right? So if they, you know, if it's like a straight split 80-20, there is no real, you know, what you're already flat 20%, right? So you're just going to let it flow for the next 5 years, and you know you're going to keep on going for another deal rather than let me see whether I can squeeze more NOI here. Let me do something more creative here, which is going to be a win-win for the sponsor, and also the passive is going to win too, right? So yeah, straight splits are very, very fundamental motivation, which is basically, you know, just normal motivation, right?
So right, it's like 85% of the deals you and I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Correct.
So what, on a what's a preferred return?
So preferred return means investors get paid first, right? So any cash flow that comes from the deal, investors get preferred return. So if they don't get paid, usually it accrues to the next year, right? So that's the meaning that I know on preferred return, unless you have other things, but that's what I see, right?
When you say accrue, do you mean like a catch up next year?
Catch up. Yeah.
So they're not going to lose. Yeah. So if the property doesn't perform as expected the first year, and let's say they have an 8% pref and only get 6, that means no one else is getting paid. They're going to get the first 2 next year to catch them up, and then their 8 starts all over again.
Yes.
That's important for people to know, because they don't, a lot of people that are listening don't do deals that have prefs, and those are good deals or
pref returns. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, as I said, I was like really figuring out what is the best way to do a really good deal, because I like to do deep value add deals, which doesn't cash flow very well in the beginning, right? Because we are going around turnaround. But how do I compete with another guy who's giving a very high cash flow? Because sometimes people say that, oh, that guy is better because he's giving me 8% cash flow. But here I'm doing a very difficult deal, which is going to pay a lot more once the whole repositioning is done and when we sell, because we are bringing up equity, right? We have equity multiple, right? So how do I do that? So then I was thinking, okay, if I give a pref, that means I'm promising you every year I'm going to give a pref return and I'm going to catch up. That's going to be a really, really compelling argument for any passive investors. People love that, especially right now, COVID, right? How many deals are not paying?
Right.
On a straight split.
Right.
That's nothing, right? If the sponsor stop, you stop.
Right.
But on a pref, your money is still accruing pref.
Right. So even if the property, as you said, sometimes value adds don't realize their value until the sale. But if you buy a property for 10 million, you sell it for 20, and you had an 8% pref, you did it in 3 years, well, your investors are going to get 24% before you even touch the deal. They're going to be made whole on the pref before the split even starts. Okay. Which is, I don't want to say the G word because we're trying to say guarantee at any time ever, but it's almost as good as a guarantee, assuming the deal does what you expect it to do. So yeah, prefs can be very, very beneficial.
Yeah, yeah. It's also show confidence of the sponsor. If a sponsor is really confident on the deal, give a pref. Yep. If you're not confident, then you can do a straight split, right? So pref means I'm confident, I'm good, this is going to make money. Otherwise, I'm not making money, right? So,
right. And if you're not confident, you shouldn't be doing the deal.
Yeah. What's the point, right? Sometimes people say, I just want to try. No, whatever it is, we're just going to split, right? It's a very easy way to say it, right? So if it goes down, we go down together. If it goes up, it goes up together, right? But a really strong sponsor, and this is how I said advanced investor, advanced sponsors, how Wall Street of commercial real estate works. It's like they give a pref, right? So, and also we talked about alignment of interest just now, but on a pref, we are putting passive investor first.
Right.
It's not even aligning. We are just putting them right ahead of this.
So would you say you're preferring them?
Yeah, probably. That's why maybe prefer, so,
I mean,
right?
That's what a pref is. You're literally putting the investor in front of the GP.
Correct.
And for passives that are listening, or I hate to use the word passives, for people that are passively investing that are listening, you know, these can be very good opportunities for you. You know, depending on the deal, they can be very good opportunities. You have to look at the performance of the GP and clearly look at the asset. And you and I both like value add. Value add are harder and harder to find, but now you have COVID value add. So poor property management right now creates some incredible value add deals. But anyway, that's a whole nother topic. So where it motivates the sponsor to push overall performance. So when you and I are doing prefs with our investors on deals, we could not be more motivated to get more money, because we're not going to get paid until our investors get their pref paid in full. And so we have to do the best we can, or your wife and my wife are going to be very pissed off at us.
Yeah.
And it's important, but it's important for passives and investors to understand that in that type of deal, that, you know, it's not a heavy front loaded deal. Yeah, you may take an acquisition fee, but I don't see a whole lot of deals where you're taking an acquisition fee, you're taking a due diligence fee, you're taking a exit fee, you're taking a refinance fee. Some do, but
you can do that on a straight split too, right? So
they're doing it on straight splits.
Yeah, so yeah, everybody does.
Yeah, so I mean, in some of these deals, the manager is making far more than the passive will ever make, and the manager's using their money to do that. I mean, I guess good for that particular manager, but I can't see that lasting very long.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Talk about the last point.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's also pref structure can be creatively structured, right? While maintaining passive investors, basically, too. Because when you say 8% pref or 7% pref, you're saying that fundamentally, I'm going to give you at least 7% or 8% in this deal, right? Which is awesome compared to any other investment outside. And I'm going to make on top of that, right? And you know, to push more for active investor, you can creatively do more things on the back end, right? So let's go to the next slide.
Are we going to talk about those more things on the back end?
Yeah.
Yeah, this we're getting in close to your type of deal.
Yeah, correct. So I want to I want to go through this slide. This is completely new material. I have to create this for this presentation. So doesn't exist anywhere else, not even my book that I created this morning. And so let's look at four different market cycle, right? So market cycle phase one is recovery, right? Phase two is expansion. Phase three is hypersupply. Phase four is recession. We are in a recession right now, okay? Mm-hmm. Don't believe anyone who said we are multifamily is still doing very well. I mean, it is still doing very well. It's still holding up. But in general, our economy is in a recession right now.
Right.
So if you look at, like, if I put straight split and preferred return, it works very well during the phase one recovery and expansion because everybody makes money. You know, fundamentally, everybody gets the pref return or 80-20 straight split. Everybody's making money, right? But on a hyper supply, when people stop, like right now, when COVID hits, a lot of sponsors have stopped paying. They said, okay, we want to reserve the cash, right? But on a straight split, they can do that, right? I mean, I have a lot of deals on a straight split too, and I can do that too. I said, I want to reserve my cash, which is good. But if you look at passive investors, they're also not getting anything during this time because
right.
A straight split is a straight split. There's no promise, no catch up, nothing, right? But on a pref, you have money being accruing. So your money,
right. So,
money is still working for you during downturn.
Right. So in hypersupply and recession, even if the asset is not performing for the next 6 months, you as an investor that has a pref, you know, you're still accruing, you know, that 8 or 9%. So as we all know, assets, real estate cycles, we're in a down cycle, but it cycles every 9 years, 10 years, it cycles. So you're going to hit the upswing and you kind of want to be in a pref in that scenario because you're going to get paid either way upon the sale before your GP is going to get paid.
Yep. Absolutely.
So I like the graph.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, now people are realizing right now because a lot of people are not getting paid or any no distribution, and you know that can last for another 2 years and your money is not working, right? But on a pref, it accrues, right, until a sale. And at least at the sale, the sponsor need to be at least catching you up back to whatever you lost in the year that was not paid off. You have to catch it up again. Let's go to the next slide and see. So let me give you an example. So on overall deal performance, earlier, we talked about different economic cycle. Now it's different deal performance. This doesn't matter whether good times, bad times or not. Even good times, I saw a lot of deals which not doing very well because it was not bought right or the sponsor was not good. But so an example on a deal performance where, you know, a deal is making 10%, right? Just assume it's 10%, right? But so when you look at straight split, let's say assume 80-20, the passives make more than 8% because the deal is making more than 10%, right? So 80% of 10% is 8%, right? But on a pref return, passive makes at least 8%. On a deal performance where there's a gain of at least 10%, passive make 8%. And on a pref return, passive make at least 8% as well. But if the deal goes south and making less than 10% for some reason, right? And there are a lot of deals goes south even during on the recovery right. And expansion.
Right.
On a straight split, look at that. Passive make less than 8%, right? Because there is no pref, right? So it's just whatever you're going down with me, I'm going down with you kind of thing. Right.
So, down with the ship.
Everybody go down to the...
James, I'd be willing to bet if we pulled the people on here right now, I would be willing to bet that the majority of people are not seeing 8% returns right now with COVID.
Oh, yeah.
So those that are in prefs that have an 8% pref, yeah, they won't see it today. But they're going to see it when it turns around. We all know COVID's going to go away. It's just a matter of time and the economy will build back up. And you'd like to be able to kind of have that return that's kind of been banked. And so it's essentially it's almost like a promise to pay. You're going to get paid before the GP. And let's say hypothetically you're owed 24% on a 3-year deal and the deal closes and only pays out 22%. Okay. You're still going to get 22%. GP is going to get nothing. Okay. So you can say the GP sucked, or you can say, man, I really like that GP because he or she or they put themselves behind us. And we know they went through some crap. And that's the other thing, you know, investors see what the GPs make and they see how hard the GPs work. And sometimes deals don't turn out the way anybody had expected or something comes up. So this right here, I'm a big, big, big proponent of prefs. You and I both are. I can't emphasize enough how important it is for passives to look at these type of deals. It really puts them, if not an equal playing field, a greater position than the GPs on these deals.
Oh, they are greater because they're getting a pref return.
Right.
So it's not even alignment of interest. This is putting investors first in front of the, before the GP. So let's go to the next one. So this is actually figure 4.6 from my book, which I wrote like almost 2 years ago, right? So I talked about what are the differences. I mean, I'm trying to be really, really objective about it, right? So, you know, waterfall structure, which is basically a pref structures versus straight split, and pros is compensation upfront. I mean, I was thinking that everybody do waterfall takes a lot of acquisition fee, but, you know, I also realized that even on the straight split, people are doing a lot of acquisition fee. It's nothing wrong about acquisition fee as long as you can deliver your deal, right? The worst thing is people take a huge acquisition fee and never deliver anything. That's the worst, right? So, and there are a lot of deals like that too, right? So, but if you take acquisition fee and you give me a pref, okay, now you are confident and I know my position is protected, right? So, and
I've seen some 4% acquisition fees recently.
Oh, yeah.
Can you believe that? Yeah. So you get a $30 million deal and the acquisition fee is $1.2 million. Unbelievable. And they're able to raise capital, which blows me away.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah, so I just mentioned about who you know, what's the benefit for deal sponsor and, you know, straight split, sometimes there's no pressure to give pref return on day one. But, you know, even when I wrote the book, I mean, when I wrote this content, I was not aware that pref return can be accrued, right? So even though you don't give day one, but it can be accrued as well.
Right.
The cons is like it may take a few years for deal sponsor to receive compensation based on, you know, amount of work for value at deal, right? So
James, let me stop you real quick. So you said something that's very important. When you said you wrote the book 2 years ago, that you didn't realize pref can be accrued.
Yeah, I didn't know about
that. So that's a very key statement that you made. It's not that you didn't realize. Many, many deals out there that are prefs are not accruing prefs. So you want to ask the sponsors whether the pref is accrue and catches up, or whether it's just you get a pref year one, a pref year two, a pref year three. If you have an 8% pref in year two, it only pays out 6. Well, you get all 6%, but year three starts all over again. So you don't get that extra 2%. So actually when you wrote this, you were thinking the right thing, because there are many deals where there's not a catch up on the pref. So it's very important that you either talk to your sponsors or your GPs, and or a lawyer who's reviewing your documents to make sure it's clear as to whether you are getting a catch up or you're not getting a catch up or accrue, as you put it.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, we are in our own world. We think everything else is bad. But once you talk to people, once you become objective and look at open, bring down the barrier and, you know, look at what exactly is good about it, then, you know, then you realize, oh, okay, this is much better than what I have to do, right? So, and there's pro and cons in both structure, right? So, I think the rest are what we just went through right now. And the deal type, you know, you can use both waterfall structure and straight split on both structures, and you know, it works for, you know, any deep value add core or even yield play or even value add deals, right? So, let's go to the next slide. Okay, so this is a structure that I came up with after cracking my head. It's not like I came up with this. I mean, I already know some people are already doing it outside in the market, but I was really analyzing because I was doing a lot of straight split and a lot of my investors are used to straight split as well. And there's people who are invested straight split throughout their whole life. They have invested millions of dollars. When they called me, James, why are you doing this? Right. So then when I explained to them, they say, wow, that's much better structure than straight split. Right. So this is a structure where, you know, covers, you know, the three things that we talked about, right? First of all, it's like, you know, you can, so if you look at here, there's three types of level, the three classes. One is called a pref equity, where there's pref return of 10%, but you don't get paid anything on the back end, right? So this, you know, these three classes actually covers for different types of investor base. One who loves cash flow, the other one who loves the back end upside, where it gets higher return, but willing to take more risk. The last one, common equity for 500,000 minimum here. They are basically for fund to fund or LLC's equity, right? But the first two are the big one that I think I want to make sure that everybody understands. So there is a pref in between. And the first one, even though 10% return, no back and upside, but they get paid first. After the lender get paid, they are the one who get paid. So their risk is really, really low.
So that's important. I'm working on a fund right now in Houston, and ours is structured very similar. We actually have four classes, not counting the GP, but it's very, very important. Again, it's about pronouns. I mean, prepositions, excuse me, not pronouns, prepositions. As to a pref, you can have several classes with prefs, but you need to understand, are they pari passu, which means there's $10,000 and you have a 9%, 8% and 7% pref for each respective class, and they could share equally in that until their buckets are full, or are they not pari passu and there's a priority? And I think in your scenario, A1 preferred equity is actually a priority. I think you, like we, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're paying the 10% before A2 or A3 even get paid.
Yeah, yeah. A1 get paid first.
That's
if you see that.
And a priority. So you can't be, you know, some people listening may poo-poo, oh, you know what, nothing on the back end. I'm in a couple deals right now where I wish I had an A1 10% preferred equity, because I don't see a whole lot on the back end because the deals weren't managed the way I had expected them to be managed, right? And so they haven't attained the value that I would have expected. But I typical 85-15 split. But it's very important to note that it's not just a pref, it's also a priority. So it's one thing to say, you know, everybody gets a pref, but many people's funds, I'm speaking out of experience because we draft these for hundreds of people. The 10, 8, 9 in many cases are pari passu. So a dollar comes in and it's pro rata to A1, A2, A3. In your deal and my deal, a dollar comes in, it goes straight to A1 until A1's 10% bucket is filled. Then A2 and A3, you know, they get their money. And I think that's important for people to understand that.
Yeah, yeah. It works out well with the deal. I mean, all types of deal. I mean, even the deal that I recently did, I mean, my first year was like 1 or 2% return. I mean, on a straight split, that kind of deal may not be interesting for people. But when I say, hey, you have a pref, even though I'm giving you 1 or 2%, but you still have another, you know, 6%, you know, coming later, it's going to be accrued somewhere. So people are, yeah, fine with that. No problem.
Right.
But on a straight split, you can't do that, right? Because you said, you know, let's, you know, either we go up together or we go down together on a straight split.
An 80-20 split of zero is still zero.
Correct, correct. So this is the deal that we put in, you know, where, you know, I think this kind of a different structure where it matches investor preference and putting a pref, you know, with a back-end upside. Like here, you know, people talk about, I think, yeah, we talked about 70-30 GP split. People said, hey, you are taking a lot of money, 70-30. But then I said, I'm giving you a pref. I'm promising you at least an 8%. Whereas on the 80-20, there is no, there is not say promising. I'm not even giving you a pref.
Right?
Right. So it really pushes the sponsor to focus a lot on improving the deal to, and totality, because you're going to make money on the back end, right? On a refi, right? So you're going to make money on that. But at the same time, it's protecting the passive investor interests by at least putting a pref over there. So there's a fundamental basic return that the passive investors will get from this deal, even before the sponsor gets it, right? So this is a structure we put in. A lot of people love it. As I said, you know, there was a lot of interest in the deal, and people who are used to straight split, when I explained to them about the pref, they said, oh, okay, that's better. That's better than, you know, the straight split, right? Because people want to make sure that their money works, right?
Right.
And if you look at, like, for example, Warren Buffett, right? I mean, how has he become a billionaire? If you look at the past 20 years, his money has been working at least 20% IRR every year. And so and some year, of course, it doesn't work as much as 20%. It goes to 9%, but at least the money need to continue working, right? If it stopped working, like right now, let's, for example, COVID doesn't work for next two. I mean, something happened, COVID continues and nobody paying up for next 2 years. Your money is actually losing money, right? Because you're not working at all, right?
So here's an interesting concept, and I think a lot of syndicators don't get it, and you and I are completely aligned. A3. So I don't even care if it's fund to funds. It could be somebody that has $500,000. It's a very high net worth individual. So I'm of the belief, and I'm probably going to say it politically incorrectly, which wouldn't be the first time I say something that's politically incorrect, but I prefer someone coming in with $500,000 or $1 million. I will pay them more because they shut up. They do the deal. They've got lots of money. they just want to see a check every month or every quarter and they leave me alone, versus 10, $100,000 investors who have lots of questions and don't necessarily read everything that's sent out to them. So for me, I try to reward those that put larger sums of money into my deal. It makes my life easier. I'll give up a percent like you see here, or even a little bit better split to someone that comes in with more money. And in an open fund where I'm raising money over a period of time, I will give either a greater pref or a greater split to those that come in on day one that trusted me and the process versus those that come in next year after I've already picked up a couple assets. You know, that's great. They like the deal, but they're not coming in at a 90-10 split. They're coming in at a 70-30 split. You know, these other guys, they believed in me and what we were doing. And you guys are waiting to see if we actually did it. So your risk has been mitigated. So because your risk is mitigated, guess what? Your return is mitigated. You didn't have the same risk. But I really like A3, and that's exactly the way we structured our last deal. We used a 400K mark, but it doesn't really matter. You're rewarding those that come in, whether it's fund to funds, a family office, a high net worth individual. You really want those investors. Now, they're unicorns. You don't always get them, but if they're coming, it starts reducing, you know, the amount of splits you have. I personally would rather have 4 or 5 investors than 96 investors. It doesn't work that way all the time. But anyway, I don't want to go too much into fund to fund. There are legal issues surrounding fund to funds that some people do it the right way, some people do it the wrong way. So we're not here to talk about it. But I think the point is, and you and I have talked at length about them, and I've got one of those in our latest deal in Houston. They're very lucrative. If you step back and you look at this whole presentation, the bottom line is you've made it very simple here in the structure. I don't mean it's a simple structure, but you've made it very easy to understand. You're targeting 3 separate types of investors here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Typical deal, typical person listening here is targeting 1 type of investor. And so what you've just done is, and I think I started off at the beginning by saying, this is the busiest quarter I think I've ever seen. Not necessarily for legal work. I'm still catching up from Q2 and Q3 of nothing. But you've got Freddie that is not taking any more loans. You've got Fannie that's not taking any more loans for the rest of the year. It is the busiest quarter anybody's ever seen. And because it's the busiest quarter, guess what? You, me, and everybody listening in right now, we're all fighting for capital. And so not necessarily having to cut deals, but you need to make your deal look very lucrative to the capital that's out there, because it's unique for capital out there right now for passives. Passives have a choice. They have lots of choices. You know, we're at the end of the year. People are trying to get depreciation expense, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? There are a lot of opportunities out there. And in the past, while Q4 is busy, it's never been like this. So people have lots of opportunities. And one of the things I always tell people in everything is be patient. Look at the deal, wait for the type of deal you like, because if you have 1 of 3 types of investors here, and one of these types of investors, all 3 of these are represented on this call. I'm not saying they're investing with me, but I guarantee you they're all 3 represented. This appeals to everybody. It's not just 1 investor. It's not just a club investor or a New York investor. It appeals to everybody. Well,
I had 3 people who wanted to invest in A3, but it was a bit too late because we were like already oversubscribed.
Send them to me.
Just but the people did say, hey, I want to put, you know, 500,000.
I'll take them. It's fine. I'll help you out. I'll take them.
Yeah.
So are you done with this slide?
Yeah. I think that's this is a slide.
Oh, my God. Well, let me go back.
And also the last point I made is preferred returns always based on the remaining money that's remain in the deal, right? So if 50% of the money is given back, so the preferred returns on the remaining 50%, right? So,
right. So one of the things, and so that what you just saw, and James, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's your last deal.
Yeah, that's the deal that we closed yesterday. Yes.
So James and I are kind of lifting up the kimonos and kind of showing what we do for those of you that haven't invested with us. And I'm not promoting my deal by any means, but we have a deal in Katy, Texas, and we just structured a 4-class deal. I prefer 3, but we structured a 4. It's pretty funny. It is almost identical. James and I talked about it, I think a week and a half ago when I asked you if you would come on and talk. And so it's the exact same thing. We have a 10% pref. It is priority pref. And it's interesting. The people that are looking at it are older, I would say in their 60s. We poll our investors. So in order for them to invest, they've got to go through a whole questionnaire, not an investor questionnaire.
Just to cut off, I had a CPA who invested in that class, big money.
Right.
He said, I'm going to do it. I mean, if a CPA doesn't know what he's doing, that's 10%, you know, every
right.
year, right?
So. Right. And so CPAs are very risk adverse. That's their nature. They're B-type people. They're risk adverse. Why would you not try to target 10, 15, 20 CPAs or even doctors who don't understand business and they just understand, okay, if I put money in, I get a return, I'm ahead of everybody else and I get paid before anybody else. Okay, that's not necessarily a bad deal versus, okay, if the asset does really well, I get a windfall, but if the asset doesn't do very well, I don't make so much. That's the younger people. You know, I'm probably in the middle. You're younger. I'm in the 50s, very, very low 50s, like 51. But so I'm not ready for the 10%. But I'll tell you, there's a part of me after this year where 10% doesn't look that bad on a couple of my deals. I would take 10%. Had I known a year and a half ago that we'd be in this kind of COVID world right now, but nobody could have done that. But I think it's very key that people take their time. They ask questions. You don't have to be, and it's not accusatory and it's not confrontational to ask your GP questions. I think your GP would want to know that you're interested in how the deal is structured. And nothing is worse as being a GP when people ask questions after they've already invested and you realize they don't know what they invested in. They don't know what the classes even represent. So as you know, both of us, our jobs are to really educate people when we do our presentations on the funds. The asset is one thing, but I might argue on something like this, the structures we do, it's at least 50% of explaining the different options people have. And you may have had this too. I've had people that will invest a portion of money in one and then also take a unit in the 10% because in their minds, it kind of evens them out. You know,
it balances the risk, right? That they get
right
with the
return. Right. I'm putting everybody back on a regular view. Yeah. It you know, you would argue that it balances out your risk. So before we take questions, and I'm sure there are some questions, James, you and I are talking about value add deals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we've had a couple, I wouldn't say arguments, but discussions on whether they're there or not. My position is we're coming off of a market where many of the value add deals have just been scooped up. People got very lucky with compressed cap rates and they did very well, but the value adds are harder to find. And I mean, value adds by this is a dump that's in a good area and I need to put in, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 a door versus this is a deal where it's been rehabbed. It's market appearance, but the property management has suffered tremendously during COVID, didn't know what they were doing, and they're at 81% or 82% occupancy. So from my position, that's a value add because...
Oh yeah, management plays an absolutely a value
right. add. And that's the easiest thing to increase the value in. We all know if it was doing 92 to 95% pre-COVID, and now you're in COVID and it's doing 82, that's very easy to explain. That should be very easy to explain to investors. The investors don't understand that. You don't want them as investors. That's like a home run if you can find it. And I know you and I are looking hard for those those nuggets out there.
Yeah, but, yeah. The one I'm closing, the one I closed yesterday is a forbearance deal. I mean, that's like nobody have been paying. Not say nobody. I mean, there's I think like 20% of the people not paying any rents because they know the whole deal is in forbearance, right? So today we go and tomorrow we're going to start telling them, hey, you know, it's no more in forbearance, you have to pay.
Right.
So it's a good surprise for them.
Watch Q2, Q3.
I keep telling everybody on the single family, we did a ton of single family over the last 6 years. The market is gearing up for a huge dump of single family out there. They're at 9% default rate. It's been holding at 9%. Everybody's getting forbearance. And I don't care who's in office. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. The banks are going to shed some of this debt. They have to. They're not going to go through what they did before. So there's going to be, just like you're going to see it in single family, you're going to see it in multifamily. But I think the interesting thing is people are going to have to decide, do they want to go after these deals in Florida or, you know, Georgia or
Las Vegas. You
know, Las Vegas. So Las Vegas and Phoenix, people think, oh, Phoenix, it's the best market ever. Look at the returns. Okay. And I'm a big proponent of Phoenix. So I'm not dissing Phoenix MSA, but I was also a hard money lender in the 2008 through 2012. And let me tell you, the property prices in Phoenix for single family dropped by 70% in many of the areas. So to say that the values have increased, yeah, they increased from their very low, which was 60 to 70% below what they initially priced. They overbuilt Phoenix right before the market tanked. And so the worst thing could happen is you overbuilt with the expectation of people coming and the market tanks. Vegas is Vegas. They're building it, but you know, when you have COVID, it just destroys. It's like Orlando. It has a massive impact when the majority of your business, your GDP is based upon tourism. I can speak personally on New Orleans, where I had a daughter that went to Tulane, and the city of New Orleans has absolutely been decimated. It was a, hope nobody hears from New Orleans. It was a shithole to begin with the hurricanes and everything, but the tourism kept it alive. You cut out tourism, I can promise you the very few people on this website right now that would actually walk in the French Quarter right now in New Orleans. We did, and it scared my wife. We were shocked that there was nobody there. Everything was boarded up. It's unbelievable. So I think one of the things to remind people, we kind of are in a bubble in Texas. It's a very good bubble. I don't think it's a made up bubble. I think the economy is strong here. I think people are moving here. Jobs are here. People are careful when it comes to COVID, but not freaky. And I say that, and I'm now in 14-day quarantine because my daughter was just tested positive with COVID. But I'm still able to do this show. Yeah. And I'm not infecting anybody while I'm doing it. I tested negative. Not that anybody cares. But my team cares. I'm still here, team. And James cares, but there are great opportunities out there right now. Great, great opportunities. We picked up one pre-COVID. It was listed at 44 million. And we picked up for 36.25. Okay. They're not all deals like that, but they're deals out there and they're great deals, especially if they're off market. James, I'm assuming yours was off market.
Yeah. Off market.
Yeah. The off market, are incredible deals. And one of the things that I tell people, and we get a lot of new people that are calling, don't be afraid to get a deal. There are at least 80 or 90 people sitting here listening right now that would love to partner with someone that can find the deal, but isn't able to necessarily operate it by themselves. You know, there's a whole podcast and a whole, not podcast, but a whole show on our YouTube that says how to pick the right partner. Picking the right partner is like picking the right wife. It's sometimes more important. Not that picking your wife is not important, but it's very important. But there are plenty of people on here. I can just see the faces that I know would do deals if you're the guy that actually or gal that actually locks in on a deal. But then you're like, oh, shit, how the hell am I going to raise $13 million? Talk to James. James might be interested in that type of deal. I'm not saying he is, but yeah, James might want to partner on that type of deal if it's a value add deal. And it's not just James. It's Jefferson, it's Malay, it's Jim. I'm just calling out names, and I'm sure it's David, but David's not allowed to partner with, Slava's not allowed to partner with anybody but me. I see him smiling in his game chair at the bottom. But I want to encourage people to continue to go after deals. I highly recommend you read James's book. I'm not a big fan of books, and a little tidbit, I actually was one of the first people probably in this entire group that had a book published on Amazon. Jeff actually helped me publish it on Amazon. Jeff, do you remember that? Hard Money Made Easy?
I do. I think it's still on there somewhere.
It's still on there. And if any of you buy it, I'm going to shoot you because it was written in a different way a long, long time ago. You guys think I'm a smartass now?
It's in some account that you don't have access to anymore.
Right. So I'm apparently still making royalties on the book, but I have no idea how to access it or what bank account it even is on.
Texas lost money.
I'm pretty sure I beat James on sales, but I'm not going to argue with him. It's been out there since 2008. So James, I have a little heads up on you.
Oh, yeah.
A little running room on you. You're right there. Cindy, do we have any questions? Were there any questions that you saw?
There's a couple of notes on here. But someone, James, asked, what other fees do you take aside from an acquisition fee?
So we do the asset management fee, 2%. We have our own property management, 3%. And usually we do buy a broker fee because we find a lot of off-market deals ourselves. Could be like 1% to 2%. That's it, right? So very simple and lean and mean.
Sounds good. Do you prefer to distribute monthly or quarterly?
We usually like to do quarterly, but we are once the property stabilized, we like to go to monthly, right? I mean, I do not know how people can pay monthly from day one. There's no way on a cap rate, on a leverage that people do, there's nobody can pay 8% pref on a day one. The only way they do it is create a separate account and just paying out from there. It's not from real estate, right? And I do like to do that. I like to create money, take money from real estate and pay the investors, even though it doesn't look cool, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, all our money comes from real estate. So, you know, you have to wait on a quarterly basis. Once we stabilize, we are moving to monthly.
James, you must have a good CPA.
yeah, absolutely. He's from Dallas.
do I have a good CPA? Cindy?
Yes.
Tandy down there who's laughing. Tandy's our CPA. So I'm probably one of the few. I'm different. So I'm one of those, if you build it, they will come. And there are others, have them come and then I will expand. So I have always wanted to invest in incredible people and hire people much smarter than me. That's why you guys work with Cindy and not me, and Greg and not me, and Jeff and Rob and not me. I just, I'm in the back. I know how to hire people, but I don't know how to do anything else. But you hire a team so that, you know, like when you're at James's level and you've got, you know, $28 billion in properties, I'm kidding, 130 million or whatever the number is. He's at a big number right now. It's not a one person shop, and you need to make sure not only do you have a team, you have a team that's going to last. You don't want to just have somebody, then they go away and find somebody else and go away. It is a nightmare. It's like trying to find a new lawyer. Lawyers are assholes to begin with. So it's once you find the one that's the least asshole or someone nice and smart, like Greg or Cindy, you know, then you've got it made. Cindy, were there any other questions you had?
Let's see. How does the pref work with a refi? If the property is refied and the new amount is on a higher value, should the pref be paid first before the money goes to the rehab or GP?
Yeah, the way I've structured is pref is always paid on the remaining money, right? So, you know, you still get 8% pref on whatever remaining money that's left. And on top of that, you split, you know, 70-30 or 80-20 or whatever.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like, James, it's almost like we should build a little spreadsheet mm-hmm. to show people kind of real life examples. Maybe you and I can put something together and we can send it out to this group. Because they have good questions, and you know, we spent just a short period of time going over it, but these are key. And I'm just looking through. There are a lot of people here that are syndicators, and I think this is, you know, again, I'm gonna qualify this with, make sure if you're in an investment club or group, this doesn't violate your investment club or group's kind of rules. Because they have certain parameters they'd like their investments to be, their syndicators to be structuring their deals. For those of you that aren't or don't have those requirements, these are very lucrative. I'm speaking on behalf of David. He and I have done several already like this. David down there in the gaming chair with the air traffic control headphones. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I'm not going
to. There is one question that was sent to me. Someone wants to know why 1031 component is never offered in syndication.
Oh, it is offered, right? I think there are some people who are offering that.
There's some.
If it's a big money, yes, we can offer it because you can always structure the 1031 as a partner on a TIG model plus with the syndication, right? So, but it need to be a big money because there's a lot more paperwork and all kind of complication comes in.
Like Jeff, unmute Greg. Greg wants to say something.
Oh, yeah, stay away from TICs if at all possible, unless it's a huge capital partner that you're really trying to appease. Be very weary of TICs.
So my discussion, you guys have heard me probably 10 times, those of you that haven't. So think of a TIC like a marriage, because everything is kind of community property. There's no special division. But the problem with TICs is they're even a higher rate of divorce in TICs than there is in marriage. And I think the latest numbers with COVID is it's about a 55% divorce rate. I would say TICs divorce rate is much higher than that. And the litigation is great for litigation lawyers and horrible for TIC members. So the deal with TICs is when they work, they're really, really good. And when they don't work, they're really, really bad. I don't know anybody that has just done a TIC and said, it was okay. It either is a home run or you end up suing each other because you can't stand each other and there's no way to get each other out. But I agree with James, you know, if a TIC comes in with $4 or $5 million or a 1031, you may try to figure out a way to structure that, but make sure you have numerous exit strategies and ways to bring that capital back in if the TIC dissolves.
Yeah. I had an investor ask me to invest $900,000 in the raise that I did. But by the time, we need to raise like $7.5 million. But so I said $900,000 is too small for me to go through the entire, unless I can't raise the money, then I can structure, right? So
it's too small until it's not too small, right?
Yeah. Right. But that was a big amount from TIC, that 1031 money that wanted to come in.
So I think that's, Cindy, anything else?
No, you're good.
So if anybody has questions, you guys are welcome to shoot me an email. So what we're going to do, as we always do, is we're going to make this available with the PowerPoint. All of James's information will be sent to everybody. And I think a link to your book, right, James? He's on mute, Jeff.
I think I gave the link to you, Jeff, and
right.
You guys can send that out. Yeah.
So they'll have that tomorrow. And then that way, if you guys have any questions, you can email James directly too. And again, I want to thank James a lot for being on this and driving all the way from his kitchen to his study, his house.
Yeah. Well, I'm just happy because sometimes people don't explain things very well. And sometimes you are in a cocoon and you think, as I said, right, when I was writing my book, I was thinking pref return doesn't accrue. And now I realize sometimes accrue, sometimes it doesn't accrue, right? So you always have to just expand your knowledge. You're talking to different people and just talk and make your right decision, right? This is a free world, right? So